Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of Oddcast, the podcast, or A World Empowered Dialogues. Here at A World Empowered, we have a philanthropic vision. We have a vision of the world where all women, men, and children are empowered. Empowered to speak their truth, empowered to be themselves, empowered to provide for their needs, and protect and heal the environment. Every week, we bring in inspiring guests and thought leaders, founders of nonprofits around the globe, to share a message of hope and to inoculate people with the belief that they can make a difference. To share their stories of struggle and trauma and where they've come from and what they've decided to create and contribute to the world. We're adults here, having adult conversations, so often there's adult language involved, but we want to thank you for being a part of this and for sharing the message and for tuning in. So get ready for another inspiring conversation with another thought leader and get ready to get odd. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. BC here, coming to you with another episode of Oddcast, the podcast. Today, it's my distinct pleasure to sit down with my good friend, Douglas McKee. Douglas is the author of Mental Mechanics, a Repair Manual, Already Wise, Our Inborn Ability to Make Our Best Choices, and Life is All About Skills, an accredited course for registered nurses. He's currently participating in Veteran Mission Possible, an intense and innovative effort to decrease the incidence of veteran suicide. Douglas has been following the work that I've been doing with A World Empowered and has been especially enthused with the Awe Kids program that we're creating. So it's my distinct pleasure to get to have this conversation with my good friend, Douglas McKee. Douglas, how are you today, my friend?
I am fine, Brian, and thank you for all those kind words. I think. And I am enthused.
One of us is muted.
One of us is muted?
Still can't hear you.
Mine doesn't say it's muted.
We're good.
Okay, we're good. Okay.
Sorry about that.
No, that's quite all right. All right. I'm fine.
So tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. How did you get to where you are and what you're doing with your life?
I'm a nurse anesthetist or nurse anesthesiologist, whatever you want to call me, I'll show up. And about 5 years after I got out of residency, one day I realized that my patients were a whole lot more anxious about what I was going to do to them than I was about what I was going to do to them. And from that point on, I started wanting, and that puts us in the late 70s, okay? Okay. Just as a little bit of perspective. And so I wanted to find out how I could help my patients be less anxious. First thing I did was taught myself to meditate. You know, there was nobody around. I mean, I was in southwestern Colorado, and there was nobody around. There was a group of hippies living up on the mountains, and I knew they were really spiritual. You know, and the closer you got, you could smell the incense. I think it was incense anyway.
Incense or patchouli, right?
Something like that. But there, you know, so I learned to meditate. And then one day I just kind of, I walked out, I meditated in my bedroom. And when I walked out of the bedroom, I had this epiphany that says, you know, when you're meditating, you know, you are connected or reunited with all there is. It is an incredible experience, and it's bliss, and it's, you know, it's really cool. But when you walk out the door, the same old world is there. And, you know, I followed this for a while, and then I thought, you know, it has to do with thinking, because when I'm thinking, I'm not at peace. When I'm not thinking, I am at peace. So that started the whole thing about learn how people think. And I started, asking my friends, you know, the ones who were good parents. I said, how do you parent? The ones who had good relationships, how do you have good relationships? All that. And I said, how do you do it? And it became fairly obvious, I thought, rapidly, that it's all about skills. And so it just kind of, you know, there wasn't the internet at that time, so information kind of dribbled in slowly over a period of years. But then I started jotting down my thoughts. And the first thing I said is, okay, life is all, or mental mechanics is what the first book was about. And it's called a repair manual. And it, what it does is it proposes how we think. And it shows how the, you know, it's not amazing. It's not magic. You know, we think, and the way we think creates results that we either like or don't like. And, you know, there were things in the book that science hadn't gotten around to yet. But as soon as they caught up, you know, I started adding them, changes. You know, one of the biggest changes, I used to talk about fear a lot. And, but now I realize that fear and anxiety are two vastly different processes. Fear is a fully automatic, unconscious reaction to potential danger, and we have zero control over it. That's fine. You know, it saves our bacon a lot. Anxiety, on the other hand, is a conscious process. And some guys in France figured this out about 10, 15 years ago, and they tracked the neural traffic. And the neural traffic for anxiety goes to the prefrontal cortex, where it's evaluated and a decision is made. And if the outcome is going to be scary, then it fires off fight or flight. So fear and anxiety feel the same, but we don't want to do anything about fear, but we are absolutely able to use the processes that already exist in our brain to significantly, I would say 70 to 80% of our anxiety can be prevented.
I look forward to getting into that a little deeper. One of the things that I started when I was working with the kids, so I was the youth facilitator for the Grand Families Coalition. You know, these were children that were adopted by their grandparents because their biological parents lost their rights. So you can imagine the horrific situations and circumstances that these youth had endured to end up in that position. And, true. You know, I taught them that our beliefs create our thoughts create our feelings create our actions, and our actions create our results, which leads back to support our inner beliefs. So if we really want to change our lives, if we want to head in a different direction, the first thing that we ought to look at are our beliefs, like our belief about ourselves, our belief about our potential. And how does that resonate with some of the scientific findings and what you've learned and written about?
It resonates loudly. There's an awful lot of need for self-reflection, not necessarily self-doubt. I gave up, you know, believing that everything I know is actual. As a matter of fact, there's how many, 7 billion of us on the planet now? And I think there's 7 billion different realities, which ought to tell us something. But children are especially vulnerable to things like that, because that's one of the neatest sciences, you know, scientific things that came out in the late 90s was by a group up in Canada. And what they did is they started looking at how do children learn, toddlers. Okay. And I gave you the quiz that I gave everybody else when I asked you, you know, true or false, at least 90 to 95% of our serious emotional problems and suffering come from three things we do all the time: relationships, make choices, and manage emotions. Is that true or false?
True.
And you said true. Definitely. So my next question was, how old are we when the development of our skills with those three things peaks? And if I remember correctly,
I answered that question very wrong. I thought that, you know, our development of those skills would probably peak around somewhere between 18 and 25. They say that, you know, your brain isn't fully developed until around 25, 26. So that was kind of my assumption. And you shocked me with the answer that you had arrived at scientifically.
Well, it wasn't that I really arrived at it. I just copied what they said. And what they said was 18 months.
That's crazy to me.
Yeah. What we tend to think is that children, babies, are basically not learning much. But they're using, you know, the part of their brain that they're using is our mammal brain. And it has no language, has no capacity to reason, and has no sense of time. What it does is it watches the watches and copies the behavior of the individuals in that little tiny environment. Okay. You know, just like, you know, a cat learns to be a cat by watching other cats, you know, dogs and dogs, you know.
That's why it's easier to train a dog when you already have a well-trained dog.
Something like that. Absolutely. You know, once you're well-trained in training dogs, when you speak dog, training a dog is okay. And if you speak cat, you can get along with them. I don't think you could ever train one. But so anyway, those guys said that the development of our skills with relationships, emotions, and making choices begins at the moment of our conception, peaks at 18 months, is mature before we start school, and even our executive network, you know, the thing that's supposed to make us so intelligent and everything, that's mature by age 7 and unlikely to change after that. And what it tells me is that the reason we have so many problems as teens and adults is that we're using the life skills designed and built into us and habituated, you know, into our brains for managing a 5-year-old's world to run our lives as teens and adults. And so they just don't work.
This is why we often hear people say that, you know, I'm dealing with a 40-year-old adult child. So we literally haven't grown beyond the skills that we acquired in infancy to be able to manage a human adult life in a healthy, well-balanced manner.
That's exactly right. And it's amazing our ability to learn incredibly complex and complicated skills and do them well. And I'm going to use airplane pilots as a marvelous example, because they are taught how to think about flying in a way that doesn't create errors.
Okay.
That's basically how they're trained. But, and they do, you know, it's safer to, you know, fly in a big jumbo jet than it is to walk across the street. However, their divorce rate, alcoholism, you know, alcohol and drug abuse rates are really high.
Hmm.
So their, you know, their emotional lives are, you know, not quite what they would like, you know, but you can point at all kinds of professions and say the same thing. I just like to use pilots because they're really trained well. And, you know, and it's one of the instructor
at the technical side of things, yeah, they're trained well.
Well, think about all the technical things, you know, my anesthesia training.
Yes.
That's very technical. I better do it right. Surgery, you know, computers, you name it. Highly technical stuff we can learn. But that doesn't really translate into having a one-on-one nurturing interpersonal relationship or decent relationship with our children.
Yeah, it's the emotional training that we seem to be lacking.
Well, that's part of it. And, you know, you led me right to it.
It seems like a distinction between EQ and IQ. The emotional quotient versus the intelligence quotient.
Well, that's true. I do have problems, you know, some philosophic problems with EQ, because it's built on our ability to identify emotions in other people and take that and use it in ourselves. And I think that I would like, I don't want to involve anybody else in my emotions,
okay,
because I create them. And actually what I think emotions are is it's the sensory part of our memories. You know, when we do something we like, our brain creates all kinds of positive neurotransmitters. And then years later, when we think about it, we still feel good.
Right.
Okay. Same thing with bad things. If we don't do something well, we create, you know, it creates bad or unwanted, maybe intolerable results. And what was reflected back to us in those outcomes is that we act in real time, but we also evaluate. Excuse me.
Get a drink.
Yeah, it's green tea. It just looks like something else.
It looks like moonshine. A big jug of it.
Yeah. But we act in real time, but we evaluate the results of our choices and our actions based on our past. And so if I do something loving, I see myself as loving. But if what I do turns to crap, I see myself as crap. It's pretty simple. So emotions are, they're just the neurotransmitters, the feelings. They're the meanings we apply to feelings.
Or the feelings that stem from the meanings that we have attached to circumstances.
Well, yeah, that's that. But it's sensory. Maybe I should use sensory rather than feelings. Because we use feelings and synonyms, or feelings and emotions as synonyms, and they aren't. Because, you know, as soon as you put on your clothes, your body feels it. But in about 15 seconds, you no longer feel it. So right. You can have feelings without emotions, but you cannot have emotions without feelings.
So what do we do with it?
Okay, what we do with it.
Our development really peaks around 18 months for our ability to navigate these challenging emotions that arise. You know, what can people do about that?
Well, the ideal thing is for parents to learn to control theirs first. So the child doesn't have to struggle with an awful lot of them and then relearn them, hopefully. But as we're seeing right now, that, you know, it's, you know, emotional turmoil is the soup du jour. You know, everybody's got it. I think I sent you a book. Did you get it?
I did get it. That was 2 days before I left for Florida and haven't been back until 1 a.m. last night. So I haven't had a chance to look at it.
Yeah, I just don't understand this. You know, good-looking guy takes off on a vacation with a good-looking girl and he doesn't do his homework.
I'm not on my phone or technology. I don't know what's wrong. My priorities are all messed up, Douglas.
Yeah. But anyway, the book is called The Continuum Concept by Gene Liedloff, and I would commend it to everyone's reading. But what it shows, she was born early in the century, and she ended up going with some guys to do some diamond hunting or gold hunting in the Amazon as a college age lady. And she met this indigenous tribe and she lived with them for a while. And then she goes back to France because that's where she's going to college. And she gets, you know, her bachelor's degree and she goes back and she lives with them again. And then she goes back to France and she ends up being a psychiatrist and she goes back and lives with them. And she makes she just drops the pearl that says, I almost missed it. What I was seeing in these people that I lived with was the evolution of parenting. She said, because they had not been messed with yet by Coca-Cola or the Catholics.
You right.
Know? They were left alone. And they had no inter-family or inter-tribe rivalries. There was no violence. The kids just ran free. Everybody, you know, it did take the whole tribe didn't work at raising them. They were just who they were. But it was such a, you know, the old kids would look after the young kids. They all played, you know, and it was, but you see, they had the needs. There's, you know, that's needs and wants. We take those as synonyms and there aren't. And there's a whole chapter in one of my books about synonyms that aren't. Because one of them is empowering and one of them is disempowering. Needs and wants are that, you know, they had needs. And they understood that that's what life was about. And needs, there's only three as far as I can tell, food, shelter, and nurturing. But the difference between needs and wants is that needs, I have to do the action to fulfill the need. I have to eat. Obviously, I'm really good at that. I have to find shelter to protect myself from the inclement weather. And if I want to meet my need for nurturing, I must nurture. And so that was all they asked. And then we come along with civilization, and civilization is all built on competition, and competition rewards aggression. So the most aggressive people become the leaders, and they can't help themselves. They're just, you know, borderline psychopaths, and they just lead their civilization off the cliff and into abysm, you know, the abyss. But that's all about wants. Wants do not meet needs. You know, fame, fortune, cash, education, whatever it is, cannot meet the need for nurturing.
So what really is that distinction, that line in the sand between a need and a want, in your estimation?
Well, if a need will take care of one of three things, food, shelter, and nurturing.
Okay.
Anything else is a want.
So emotionally, what's the distinction and how does that affect us on a daily level?
All depends. Some people have these huge emotional attachments to food, and we can see them. 50% of the of Americans are now diagnosably obese. You know, obese or better, or obese or more obese. And we have attachments to money. We have attachments to all kinds of things, and those emotions are what. Those are the attachments. We believe that those attachments will somehow bring us those wants. You know, will somehow fulfill our needs. They will make us feel whole. You know, like, you know, one of the examples I've used for years was that the teenage boy doesn't want a car because it's a car. You know, it's status, it's sex, it's, you know, mobility, it's, you know, freedom. It's all kinds of things. The want is we're projecting some kind of values in it that we think will fulfill the hole in our heart that's only fillable with nurturing.
As if it were some sort of indication of our value.
True.
That's how we base and measure our value and place in the world.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we think if we're rich, everybody's going to love us. And you know, for famous, everybody, well, whatever, you know, it doesn't work.
Yeah. One of the things that has been really important that I feel that we need to share this understanding of our intrinsic value, because I feel like we place a lot, especially in children, we place so much value in the wrong areas and don't spend enough time really exploring and researching like who we are, our place in the world, the value and gift that we can bring, the thing that makes us unique, our unique differentiator. And we try to place our value, our sense of self-worth and importance on the validation and acceptance of others. And I when I'm speaking to high schoolers, when I'm going in and talking to youth, you know, that external validation will never outweigh our internal dialogue.
True.
No matter how many voices are in the background telling us how wonderful we are, how amazing or beautiful or handsome or intelligent, or whether we're a social media influencer with 100,000 followers or we've got one friend, like, external validation will never compensate and create self-acceptance. True. We have to learn who we are. We have to understand our value. We have to believe in our competency and the quality of our hearts, our compassion and caring and nurturing for others, and place our value on those things. Because as long as we're looking for and seeking the validation, appreciation, and acceptance from other people, we're always going to be deficient. We're always going to be operating from a sense of lack and at the whims and the wills and the opinions of others.
I would say amen, pass the hat. You know, that was really good, really well done. I would say that, you know, people struggle with the whole concept of values. And what I basically, you've already heard me talking about synonyms that aren't.
Right.
And I go to great lengths to define words in ways that I think we can understand what I'm trying to say. And basically what I say about values is what we do is, you know, or what we do is what we value, and what we value is what we do. Mm. So if we want to see what our values are, we look at the choices we make and the actions we perform. We don't ask anybody else. We just look at that. And, you know, somebody like you ought to just be tickled to death to get up in the morning, because, you know, what you do is all about, you know, nurturing others. I mean, I'm just, you know, I love chills.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I told you a little bit, like, I had that motorcycle accident August 8th, 1997, and then I recovered from a drug addiction that lasted about 2.5 years after that. I've spent the majority of my life since then trying to live in such a way that if today is my last day and I'm called before my maker, that I can say that I've done the best that I can with the time that I've been given. I think that all of us, for me, I think that the key to life is to be the best version of us as possible, to find our unique value and the gift that we're meant to offer, and find a way to give that in a way that benefits society as a whole, and stop comparing ourselves to other people. And the only thing that really matters at the end of the day, at the end of our life, is how we feel about the way that we've lived, the value that we've contributed, the things that we've brought to our loved ones or society at large. And since my accident, I want to be able to say, if I walk out on the street or I slip in the tub and I get struck by lightning or a meteor hits me, I want to be able to say when I meet my maker that I did the best that I could with the time I was given. I tried to live in such a way that I made the world a better place.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt. I'm sure your little gold crown is waiting for you, I'm sure. You know, and I you're absolutely right. But there are an awful lot of people that don't understand the difference between needs and wants. You see, if let's go back to the toddler. The toddler doesn't know what it needs. It knows what it wants. I mean, you know, aside from, you know, my tummy's, you know, I'm hungry, give me something. You know, they're fairly vocal, but it's learning. And that's the modeling of behaviors by others.
Okay.
Shows us what's important. And that's how we are conditioned, you know, from the get-go. And I'm sure that Elon Musk had a meltdown not too long ago about what's Bezos's wife's name, who's giving away all the money. And Bezos just can't figure that out. How can she give away $100 million? You know, she's an idiot. Well, I think, well, that's not the reason she's alive, is to get more money. But see, he doesn't get it. She gets it. It's pretty simple. When we help someone else, that's the thing that we see ourselves as helpful. But when we take from somebody, like you said, there's no amount of fame or fortune can cover it up in here.
Again, we need to understand the thing that we can contribute, that the value that we offer and how we can make a difference. Because at the end of the day, that's the only way that we'll ever find self-acceptance. And to know that who we are as a person is good enough at our core, because we act and live from that place and know the value that we bring and that we do make a positive, even if it's just not just, but even if it's raising good children and having a tight-knit family, and the rest of your life is spent doing a menial job that you don't enjoy, but knowing that the impact that that has and that you're living your life as the best version of you as possible, we have to know that. We have to know that it's not based on other people's opinions. And again, I think helping children figure out the difference between needs and wants will be very valuable to know that. I don't know. It just goes back for me. It goes back to the feeling that all of our priorities as a society are very misplaced at the moment. And
I could not agree with you more. I mean, that's basically the reason that there are so many people so upset. They're adrift.
Yeah. And I mean, nihilism, right? You're familiar with Viktor Frankl, I believe it was a psychiatrist in Auschwitz and Dachau. He wrote once that there's nothing so powerful as the knowledge that there's meaning to one's life.
Yeah, it is. And whenever I am tempted to listen to my genes in my early programming and, you know, get pretty fussy, I think about Viktor, because he was in the concentration camps for 3 years and he came out whole. I mean, W-H-O-L-E with a capital W. And I think if he could put up with that and go from inmate to inmate, comforting, helping, I have no excuse. I mean, he was on the ragged edge of being killed every day, all the time. Just if a guard took a whim, bam, he's dead. And he just, it was like, it is what it is. I mean, he was at one time a phenomenal Christian, a phenomenal Jew, and a phenomenal Buddhist. He was just everything good about mankind. I have lots of quotes, but the one I like, besides yours, is that the brain is a stimulus response organ, but between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space lies our ability to choose, and in our choice lies our freedom. And so that's why, you know, your effort and your absolute dogged determination to help these kids learn how to meditate is so critically important, because meditation to me turned out not to be the destination, but the beginning point, the starting point.
Yeah, that's the vehicle.
Yeah, I want to share something.
We call it intentional breathing. Because there's often a religious connotation that people tend to associate with the word meditation. I actually don't personally agree with that. My familiarity with Buddhism, I don't actually associate that with a religion that's not praying to or worshiping a particular deity. But in our program, we're teaching intentional breathing, simply breathe to the point where your diaphragm expands or diaphragm fills and your belly expands, rather than breathing to the top quarter of your lungs. And that simple action of breathing in through your nose until your belly expands instigates or incites the vagus nerve and decreases our sympathetic nervous system and gets rid of cortisol and gives you the oxytocin, the cuddle chemical, and helps you feel connected to and part of other people. The benefits to intentional breathing, even outside of a quote unquote religious practice like Hinduism or Buddhism, it has incredible medically proven benefits on all kinds of different areas. You said you wanted to show something that you wanted to share.
I wanted to share something. Where'd that thing go?
Was it this?
No, it's this one. Let's see, where are we?
The butterfly quadrant?
No, it wasn't the butterfly quadrant. It's the next slide after that. It's that one. Yeah, the butterfly quadrant. Yeah. Okay. And the reason of what I want to talk about is, you know, and you're absolutely right. When if you watch babies breathe, they breathe abdominally. But by the time they're in the first grade, they're breathing in the top half because they're anxious. Okay. Now, what almost all contemplation, we can call it contemplation, almost all of the practices begin with the breath, a huge number. And what it does is we can no longer breathe abdominally and think about the usual stuff that's going on in our life. We have to put so much focus on that we enter that state because we are not thinking about the stuff that bothers us. What we're thinking about is the air. And it just actually moves us to this point here. You know, I got two arrows. But anyway, this one, you know, on this butterfly quadrant, you know, it took me years to kind of get, you know, my brain wrapped around this. But, you know, there's that story about the butterfly flapping its wings can set into motion, you know, forces that will turn into a tornado. But basically what it is how a tiny bit of energy can make a huge change, or an individual can make a huge change. And what I was talking about is, you know, when we are practicing those with breath or whatever you want, whatever label you want to use, this is the point. The crosshairs is where we want to be, because this up and down is energy, and the right to the left is actions.
Okay.
And so if we're looking at, you know, if we're looking at the negative side and we're liberating energy, it's still competition, which is negative. If we are looking here and, you know, we're down here in real tough stuff, then we're constraining. We're actually keeping things from happening. But over here, we can actually be making positive actions, but we're maintaining. That's what happens in huge organizations like religions. You know, you have the brilliant, brilliant mind and soul and spirit that says, I'm what you can be. I'm nothing special. I'm just you making different choices. But pretty soon, you know, they have a flock, and then pretty soon they need some maintainers, you know, some bureaucrats to take care of it and keep it going. Mm-hmm. And so they work hard at making sure that things don't change. And so, but here is the point. This is the point that I like to be when I'm doing a practice. Or this is a point where if we train our brain to do this is the point where we will live. We will be here. we will not automatically react to anything. We will maintain our peace. And that means we're at zero. We get to make a choice. This is the space that Viktor Frankl was talking about, because we can make the choice, and we do make the choice. That's the only essence of free will that we have, is the our ability to make the choice of what are we going to do next. And this is where you live. This is where you live. And this
most
is where
of the time, I work to stay there. Sometimes I oscillate between all four quadrants, depending on how much sleep I've gotten or my personal finances or personal relationships. But yes, I do strive to maintain equilibrium and stay in that upper right-hand quadrant of collaboration between liberating and positive action.
Yeah. Well, you see, before we had civilizations, everything we did as tribes was built on cooperation, collaboration, and coordination. Coordination, collaboration, and cooperation. Okay. But that doesn't work in ours. We do not collaborate. We do not cooperate. We do not coordinate. You know, everybody's kind of out there grabbing what they can, you know, running off with it. And so we miss it. We miss the opportunity.
Why do you think that is? Because my initial impression is, in today's society, we operate predominantly from a scarcity poverty mindset, which keeps us in the either constraining or conserving quadrants. And I'm quite certain that that's where the majority of people operate the majority of the time, is that conserving, constraining quadrant based on a poverty or lack mindset. And I don't understand why we've gravitated to that degree, if that hypothesis is accurate. When we live in the most opulent time in human history, why did they not fall into that pitfall of poverty mindset when they were, you know, living on the prairie in the tribes? First of all, do you think my hypothesis is correct, that the majority of the time that we live in that poverty mindset, and that's why we
I think you're right. I think, you know, I think you're right. I said just a little bit ago that all civilizations are built on competition. It begins that they're competing for a limited number of resources. And in biology, what it says is competition is striving for a goal that cannot be shared. Okay? So that's why all the wars are fought, because somebody else has something we want. We go after it because, you know, they won't give it to us. But eventually, it creates within the people, they're competing for a job. They have to feed themselves because we no longer have the ability to feed ourselves. So we have to compete with a job. We have to compete. And in the last couple hundred years, human beings only change when the environment in which they live changes enough that they must change in order to survive and thrive. Sound reasonable? Okay. And if you look at the last couple hundred years, or the last hundred, you can see that the velocity of change has been so great that everybody's focus has switched from cooperation, collaboration, and coordination and our interpersonal relationships to learning new skills so they can survive. In the late 20s, you know, the Lehman Brothers Bank, one of their guys said, we need to re-educate the human mind toward desires. We cannot stand this thing of them meeting needs. We want them to chase desires, because that's a hole that will never get filled. And the banker knew it. And so then they started saying, instead of these boots will last forever, just say, well, don't these boots look nice? You know, here, get this nice looking car, get this nice looking dress, get this nice looking suit, whatever. You know, join the good guys. I mean, that's where the advertising went. And so we were seduced by the dark side into becoming truly competitive, you know, and, but the competitive, the always competing, you know, we are behind, like you said, we're functioning from a position of lack where we don't have the lack actually, but we have been taught that we do.
Yeah. I mean, in this country, at least, even the quote unquote impoverished are better off than anybody was 300 years ago. You know, yeah. The low income, middle class America, even the impoverished in this country, at least, and you and I have traveled around to some developing countries and we know what true lack and struggle is, but we're better off on the whole than anybody was 300 years ago, save for the top 1%. And we still have this insatiable need to want for more. And it's curious how that is so ingrained.
Well, you see, if you take a look at our attitudes, our relationships, and by the way, all our brain does is relationships, imaginary, real, physical, you know, whatever. But what was I going to say?
Paying attention to relationships.
Right. But we learned those before we could figure out that they didn't work. Because you see, the toddler brain has no ability to reason. So it accepts everything as a fact.
Okay.
And then it practices what it knows until it becomes, you know, the subconscious habits. But it can't reason. And by the time it can reason, it doesn't. It never occurs to it. And an awful lot of people, I think, are drowning in their own suffering because they've tried to change. They've tried diligently to change, but they didn't know how to change. There's so many shysters out there saying, act as if, pretend that you've got it, you know. Picture this, the secret will get you anything you want. Well, the secret won't, because there's a big difference between synonyms, you know, aren't. Intention and expectation. Intention is hoping something will work, and expectation is what you believe is going to work.
Exactly. So that goes back to my wheel of life and how your beliefs create your thoughts, create your feelings, create your actions.
Yeah.
There is value in act as if you can actually get to the place where you're grateful for what you already have and what you know you will eventually get. It gets you out of that poverty mindset. So I don't entirely disagree with the premise, but I do think that there's a lot of holes. And one of the biggest things, to your point, that I think it leaves out is that belief part. Because if you don't believe that you can get what you want, or if you don't believe that you deserve to have what you want, you will immediately either repel or destroy whatever it is good that's coming into your life.
Well, I think most stress and depression is built on the belief that you won't get it. Yep. I mean, I talk about fear and anxiety. Let me kind of clarify that just a little bit. My chief always said that all the processes that are at work in our body and our brain are conserved. In other words, they've been there for a long time, and because they have pro-survival functions. Now, so what possible pro-survival function could anxiety offer? And all I thought about was, finally, I read a little ditty by some anthropologists, and it kind of dawned on me that actually anxiety, far from being a mental illness, is one of the most important conscious concepts or conscious processes our brain ever developed, because it gave us the ability to imagine a known danger. Now, this is a million years ago, so think lions, tigers, and bears. And develop skills and strategies to avoid becoming lunch. Okay? Now, there's some people out there now saying depression. No, depression is biologic, you know. I'm going to say, well, it can't be. Because if you go sit down out in the middle of the things where you're surrounded by lions and hyenas and everything, you're lunch. And those genes would disappear. So it's not a genetic deal. But we don't have lions and tigers and bears today. What we have is our imaginary futures, where we are either going to lose something we have, we're going to not get something we want, or we are going to get something that we do not want. That is our belief system. See, our belief system is based on our ability and our skills at being able to create tolerable and sustainable results. And if I've tried and tried and tried and it doesn't work, pretty soon, no matter how much I want it to work, I come to the belief that it won't. And that's depression. That's helplessness, hopelessness. And yes, it's a reflection of my experience.
So do you believe there's any chemical, physiological, or genetic influence on depression, or you believe that's entirely psychosomatic and it's all a fabrication of our imagination? Because it seems to me that I have met some people that seem to have a legitimate chemical, physiological abnormality or deficiency. So I would imagine that at least from my experience and some of the people that I've met, that it can be an actual chemical issue, which could be genetic.
Well, the Pfizer study that nailed that was, and that's a big thing on Google, was take this test and see if you need an antidepressant.
Right.
And basically didn't matter what you answered, it was going to lead you to, yes, you need one. And so they talked about a chemical imbalance in the brain, and the chemical imbalance is there, but it is the result. It is not the cause.
Okay.
People don't get depressed just all of a sudden. It takes a while. And it's that chemical imbalance, the chemical changes, because if you think happy thoughts, you're happy. If you think peaceful thoughts, it's peaceful. But if you think you're worthless and you're hopeless, and no matter how hard you try, then it's
never going to work out. Yeah. And that to me is the pandemic of our society, especially today. I mean, Viktor Frankl talked about it in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, how nihilism is the undoing of man. And this belief that nothing we do matters, who we are doesn't matter, and it's all for naught. Which is completely despairing. Like if that's truly your fundamental belief system, that nothing you do will matter, nothing ever matters, you came from dust, you return to dust, and everything's going to be gone and it doesn't matter, then that's a totally depressing and a catastrophic belief system to operate from. So it's impossible not to be a manic depressive if that's your fundamental belief system.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, because the chemicals that are part of your thought create the feelings that reflect back to you who you are. Okay, I'd like to share something else.
Yeah, and our minds can't tell the difference between reality and imagination. You know, you can sit there and you can play a movie in your mind of an imaginary outcome and still have the same feelings, and you know, you can still get the same dopamine hits. You can still get the serotonin spikes. You can still have the same physiological response to your imagination as you would to an actual outcome or an actual event. You can foretell this and create PTSD. These feelings.
PTSD is one of the best examples of that, because PTSD doesn't happen instantly after a real traumatic event. It happens, it takes 60 to 90 days to develop it.
Okay.
And, you know, nobody quite knows how to, you know, what the flashbacks, you know, what is the actual trigger. But there's a trigger in there that says this is danger. And danger, the most dangerous thing that you can happen is that's, you know, the what happened to them. Let me share. I'm gonna share this thing again. And I want to talk about anxiety a little bit.
So you're saying anxiety is the physiological response to an imagined future.
Yes. Yes. And this is, I think, one of if I want to be proud of something that I've done, this is it. I want you to think about learning to drive. Do you remember how anxious you were when you learned to drive?
Yeah. I mean, my dad was the one teaching me, so.
Mine too. So anyway, so here we are. There are two, you know, two components. And what it is this is the one of severity of the consequences, and this is the level of competence, and this is anxiety. So if our competence is low, which is zero when we're learning to drive, and the consequences are potentially fatal, then our anxiety about being able to do the skill without triggering the consequence is enormous. That's what anxiety is. I'm predicting a future. I'm going to kill myself with this car.
Like skydiving for the first time.
That's right. You can see ketchup, right? But
exactly.
Anyway, so after we do this level, you know, after we become more competent, our anxiety starts decreasing because we are learning to trust ourselves to do the skill without triggering the consequences. Can you see that?
Yeah.
And
before we continue, I have a question.
Okay.
So what do you say to those who have sudden onset panic attacks? They're incredibly anxious to the point of like heart palpitations and racing, but they say, because I've known people that have gone through this, they say that it's come out of nowhere. They literally weren't thinking about anything, but it just came. What do you say to that scenario?
Okay. I
are they simply not aware of their thoughts?
One of them called me when they are not. And it's, you know, what is the trigger? Doesn't matter. What is the response is the critical part. One of my daughters called and I answered the phone and she said, I'm going to have a panic attack, because she'd had a few. And like she said, you know, I mean, you just get this kind of, it's kind of like an aura. It's kind of like you're going to have a seizure or something. You know it. And I said, well, sit down. She says, she said, I'm on the freeway. And I thought for about 2 seconds and I said, what? That's the dumbest thing you could possibly do. You're driving the car. You can't have a damn panic attack. What do you think you're doing? She said, why are you yelling at me? And I said, well, I had to get you mad because you changed your mind.
Right.
And I said, how's your panic attack? And she says, gone. I said, right. I said, call me when you get home and let's talk about this. Because you see, you talked about, you know, the thing that goes on. I'm going to. You talked about the. The chemical balance and how yeah. And what, you know, what the, you know, you talked about the movie and what the panic attack is probably, it is the highest example of what human imagination can do, because we accept it as absolute. We accept that it is happening now. We accept that it, you know, I am unable to stop it. I do not know what is happening, and I'm completely out of control, and I may die. And what I do is I teach people, you know, it's a mental chemical spiral. know, I just like a rocket taking off. I said, but when you feel it, it's a mental chemical process. When you feel it start, reach over and turn off the light switch. And just that amount of involvement stops it. Because, you know, once they hear somebody say it's a mental chemical race, but we have to believe that it is real, that it is, you know, and the catecholamines that it's creating are actual. But there isn't, and I think the one thing about panic attacks is nobody knows why they have them. Nobody knows what they're panicking about. Now, as PTSD, they know exactly what they're panicking about. But with, you know, with panic attacks, it's unknown. So I say, well, if you don't know it, there isn't one. All it is this, it's this kind of this wild, you know, eruption of thought, chemical, thought, chemical, thought, chemical, and it just takes off. But I said, if you just reach over and turn off the switch, it stops the process.
So what's a life skill that can help them turn off the switch? Is it that actual thought and movement?
That's just
that process that's been like off.
When you feel it, reach over and turn off the switch. Because you said the whole thing about going back to the quadrant, and there's two things that have to happen in life is all about skills. Number one is that we need to be able to stop doing the things that are causing the problems. And most of that is we need to stop our negative thinking. Okay. Now, we can do that. We do it all the time. I mean, true or false, you can change your mind instantly when you think you need to.
True.
Okay. I have an awful lot of, not an awful lot, but I have more pushback on that than any other question I ask. And so I've kind of been trying to think about how to language it differently. And what
I believe you get a lot of pushback on that. I think that I'm kind of an exception in that area. I think a lot of people will tell you that they can't change their thoughts or emotions that quickly.
Okay. That's why I came up with this. And let me see what you think of it. Okay. How many times during all the conversations that you have during the day do you say the first thing that pops into your mind?
Me personally?
Well,
almost never.
That's right. Almost never. That's right. And so you see what that tells you is that you are okay. You thought one response, you say, no, I'm going to say something else. You changed your mind instantly because you thought you needed to. And so what it tells us is if we can change our mind instantly when we think we need to, guess what? We can change our mind when we want to.
Yeah, it's kind of like you're trying to get somewhere and the directions on your GPS tell you you need to turn right at the next light, and you get there and there's an accident or someone's, you know, lying in the street. You instantly tell, okay, I can't go that way. I need to go a different way. I need to circumvent this situation and change directions, even if it's only momentary. You can change your mind about something like that quickly. That indicates that, yes, you can change your mind about anything that quickly.
That's exactly right. And that's one of that's the basis for the first skill that I teach people. And because as you said, thoughts are like movies. Now, we'd never watch a movie that we didn't like, would we? We would change the channel or turn off the set. And that's why the movie's called change, or the skill is called change the channel. And it uses our ability. Because the only reason people don't change their minds is they don't know how to access that subconscious process that goes on in our brain consciously. They don't know how to use it. So what I do is say, this is how you use it. And it's based upon, there's a huge difference between worry or anxiety and danger. Danger is smoke, fire, guns, knives, poisons, and politicians. And when you see danger, what do? You run, right? But if you're feeling a little anxious or angry or some negative emotion and you look around and there is no danger, where are those feelings coming from? they're coming from the story that you're telling it. Those are part of the memories, part of the association, part of the meaning are those negative emotions. But they're part of the movie. So it also uses the thing between sensation and perception. That, you know, like Viktor Frankl said, there is a space. This is the space. The space is you heard it. Your perception over here says change. Okay, so there it is. There's the space. So when you start feeling a negative emotion, you look around. Is there danger? That's two things. It stops the process, just like in a panic attack or anything else. It stops the process because you're looking, is there danger? And when you ask, when you say the word danger, that part of your brain comes online. And believe me, that takes precedence because your survival takes precedence over everything else. Okay, so you look to the right, you look to the left, is there danger? If there's danger, run. And if there's not, you have the option then to change the channel, to think about something, to choose your next thought. And so when you do that, you choose something that is either neutral or a pleasant memory. That's really important because neutral, like a fact, or there's a picture, there's whatever, or a pleasant memory, because your brain can verify those. That's why most positive thinking techniques don't work.
Yeah, it's a constant tug of war.
Yeah, your brain says, BS, I'm out of here.
The cognitive dissonance thing gives you rote burn because all day long, I mean, I tried that, man. When I was depressed and really low and had the worst self-esteem you could imagine, I would tell myself, I love myself, I love myself, I love myself, you know, 10,000, 20,000 times a day. And it was this constant tug of war. I love myself. No, you don't. I love myself. No, you don't. And it didn't, I mean, it kept, as long as I kept doing it, it kept the pendulum somewhere in the center. But as soon as I stopped, it would swing all the way back to the other side again.
Yeah. That's why change the channel is so cool, because it accesses the same pathways in our brain as breathing practice or whatever, but it takes 5 seconds or less. And it's much more applicable to the Western mind, because a lot of people will not take time to do the practices. I love to tell the story about, I work in a teaching hospital, so I'm surrounded by students of all kinds and everything. And one day there were a group of four nice young women. And so I taught them change the channel, not realizing that one of them was a chief resident. Now chief residents don't ask for advice. They give advice. Well, actually they give orders. So the next day I bumped into her and I said, so you've been using change the channel? And she said, yes. And I said, do you think it'll change your life? She said, already has. And I said, well, that's music to my ears. Tell me how. She said, it's a tool that I can use. And it is implementable. It is insightful and it's applicable. Bingo. Done. And she said that, and she says, so I use it. She said, I taught it to my daughter, who's a CEO. And what she does is she uses it to interrupt all the trash that's going on so she can be more productive at work. Because it's about getting to that zero point where we make the decision, not our baby brain.
Yeah, I believe it was Lao Tzu that said, between your breath and your thought, there's a space. Let's meet there.
Yeah. It's really cool because the space exists. It's the perception, like a sensation, and naming the sensation. And that takes anywhere from 0.2, from 20 milliseconds to a half a second. And so one of the blogs I wrote said that it's the most important half second in your life. And
just to know that it exists, no matter how minuscule it might seem. A lot of people believe that their emotions are literally a reflex, that there is no gap whatsoever between an event happening or some inciting trauma or whatever, and the emotional response that ensues. Somebody could say the wrong thing, and in an instant, they're flying off the handle. And in their mind, they feel like it's just a reaction. There's nothing I can do about it.
You cannot imagine how many people have told me I'm crazy. Because, you know, when I say anxiety is a habit, you thought I would have really insulted them. They say, you think I like being this way? You know, I'm going to. But
so what do you say to the people that push back on that? Because I do imagine, especially someone who's suffering from anxiety and depression, they want to and need to feel validated and heard and feel like what they're going through is normal and that it's not really their fault. So they would naturally have a pushback and, you know, an allergic reaction to hearing that.
Well, I usually explain to them what, you know, what anxiety actually is, and that it is not a mental illness. I said, doesn't matter what somebody tells you. I said, let's look at the facts. I had a patient once, we were going to do a little cataract surgery, and we covered her up, and she says, stop. And I pulled up the sheet and I said, what's the matter? And she said, I'm having anxiety. And I said, so? She said, I can't do this. And I said, wait a minute. This is what I want you to do, is every time you start feeling anxious, I want you to kind of in your mind, look around and see if there's any danger. Now, there isn't going to be any danger. So I want you to think about your grandchildren. You have grandchildren? Yes, I do. Okay. Think about them. She got through the procedure really well. And I explained it to her after we got done, just a little bit more in depth. She came back a year later for her other one. And I almost walked past her, you know, because she looked, I looked at her and I said, what have you done? I said, you look so much younger and relaxed. What have you done? She said, I don't have anxiety anymore. And I patted her on the shoulder and I said, that's great. She said, no, you don't understand. And I said, what am I missing? She said, I'm 58. She said, I have been in therapy and on meds for my anxiety since I was 16. She said, I'm no longer in therapy. I'm no longer on meds. She said, because I no longer have anxiety. She said, for the first time in my life, she said, I control my anxiety. It does not control me. I said, that's great. She said, I do change channel a lot, though.
So, and all of that happened in a manner of 15, 20 seconds, one time in an operating room with you.
That's right. That's right. People.
So 42 years of wasted therapy and probably what are they called? Those drugs.
Psychoactive drugs, you know what I mean?
Yes, the psychoactive drugs.
And I, you know, all that junk. Not to mention the waste of her time. You know, I have 60% of our waking hours since COVID arrived are thinking about junk. It's anxiety.
Elaborate.
Yeah. Okay. They're thinking about, it's called a wandering mind. Some guys in Harvard 2009 published a study. What they did is they built an app for an iPhone and then got 2,500 or so people to sign up. And what they did is the phone would call them at random times and say, what are you doing? What are you thinking about? Is it positive, neutral, or negative? And in 2009, 46.9% of the time, people were thinking about something other than what they were doing, and their thinking was negative. In other words, almost 50%, if they sleep 8 hours, that's 16 hours, they're throwing away, they are absent for half their day. But now it's up to like 60%. And some people, when I ask them, how much of your day do you think you're throwing away in this? Some of them say 80 to 90. See, their life is, they can't make a different choice. They're too busy thinking about, you know, the storm that's on its way. And that's why, you know, change of channel is so incredibly important in the breath work and everything, because it gets you to zero. But then what they need then from zero is skills that will create more tolerable and sustainable results, like in driving, that avoid the creation of negative emotions.
So what would be a good skill for that?
Well, that's what, you know, that's why I remediate the skills of relationships, emotions, and making choices. Because if we know how to do something, you know, we create good results and we're happy, we're okay with it. Just like in that, you know, in the graph, you know, when our competence is equal to the consequences, then we don't have anxiety. I mean, you get in a car, you just drive. And so, you know, what I teach is that, you know, once you're skillful with relationships, you're competent. Once you're skillful with making choices, you make the choices that evolve your life and benefit those around you. And, you know, and there are not very many negative emotions that you have to tend to. But if there are, you look at them and you can know that I'm feeling bad now. It's a negative emotion. But generally, you know, my cat died or something like that. You know, there is a reason. It's not an imaginary story. There is a reason that I have negative emotions.
Have you noticed or come across people who have kind of used their anxiety and depression as a badge of honor? I've met a few people that seem really intent on holding on to that as a label, sort of to a degree that it feels like it's a badge of honor. I have anxiety or I have depression, and it feels like it keeps them stuck. Like it almost puts a lid on their box and they have a really tough time being open to ideas that can do anything about it, because they've almost built an identity around it and it would sacrifice or undermine that belief system of who they are and their place in the world.
Too many. And my nickname in the operating room is Thumper. You remember Thumper and Bambi?
Yeah. Bird.
That's right. But with people like that, I say, so would you give it up if you could? I mean, I get right in their face. Would you give it up if you could? But I can't, so it doesn't mean anything. I say, okay. And I just, you know, I'm not going to mess with them. I mean, not because a frontal attack would do nothing except cement it more, because venting is cementing. Yeah, you probably went to some, group therapies.
Yeah. Psychologists, where you talk about your problems. And
yeah,
I've always felt it was like carving my name in a tree, just etching that.
Well, like I said, venting is cementing. If there isn't a solution, that's why going back to the anxiety graph, I say, when you start feeling anxious, say, what am I anxious about? Name the skill, name the outcome that you are anxious about. And then say, okay, I may not have the skill now, but I can find somebody who can help me upgrade the skill that I need. Right. Somebody can help me upgrade that skill level to where I am more competent. Because if they ask that question, they don't go wandering off into the abyss of wild, uncontrollable anxiety, because the source of their anxiety is their inability to do something in a way that it will result in a tolerable and sustainable outcome.
Yeah, so the question of, do I have the skills or can I learn the skills to manage this to get what I want?
That's exactly right.
It's like that old aphorism. How did that go? If there's nothing I can do about it, there's no use in worrying. If there is something I can do about it, there's no reason to worry.
That I would say that, you know, yeah, but hopefully the person who said that knew what to do about the thing.
Ideally.
Yes. Because he might see somebody else.
Go ahead.
Yes, yeah, he might. I was going to say he might see somebody doing it and know that it can be done. But I watch basketball players all the time, and I'm just absolutely just amazed by their skill. I couldn't do that. Too old, too
short. I could practice for a million years, and I'll never be able to dunk.
That's exactly right. I'm physiologically limited, you know. But you know, it does bring up a kind of a thing. Let's say you're out there shooting hoops, and Michael Jordan walks up and he says, "You mind if I give you a couple pointers?" You wouldn't say, "What do you know?" You'd say, "Oh, please do," or "Please do."
Yes,
yeah. And he'd say, "Well, you need to do this, and you need to hold the ball a little bit, and you need to keep your foot down, and then push." And you go like that, and it goes, shoo. And you go, "Oh, I like this." And you get a brain stem. You know, your brain stem, you know, goes dopamine. And he says, "Now practice it 1,000 or 2,000 times." And you do, and your skill will get better. And, you know, the neat thing is when we do, just like that lady that had the anxiety and had it for 42 years, she wanted to change. She was open to change. And when she tried change the channel, she got a big dopamine hit. And that tells her brain, this works. Because if we do something and it creates a better result, we get a dopamine hit or an oxytocin hit or both of them. I mean, sometimes, you know, the cascade just goes, "Oh, I love this."
Yeah, that's what you were talking about earlier. It's either an upward spiral or a downward spiral. And it's like a chain reaction, this chemical chain reaction that's either lifting us up, taking us to new heights where we want to be, or dragging us down to the pits of hell where we burn in anxiety and fear and depression. So,
yeah,
you know, working on those skills to reach that equanimity, that equilibrium, so that we can make better choices for more positive, sustainable outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
We're at the 80 minute mark. So in the last closing parts of our podcast here, I always like to ask, you know, what has been the most powerful and meaningful lesson that you've learned from life? If there were one thing that you would like to share, and if you could inoculate the whole society with a belief or a bit of knowledge that you've acquired that's made all the difference for you, what would that be, Douglas?
The quality of my life depends upon the quality of my life skills. And so if I'm having a problem, I just need to upgrade my skills. And there are always people available who are quantum levels better at a lot of things than we are. It's just run of the mill. So you can find them. And I think that the kids are absolutely blessed to have you show up in their lives because they need you. They need that modeling. They need your wisdom. They may not the little ones may not understand, you know, your words, but they will understand the actions, because that's what teaches that baby brain in here. It doesn't matter whether we're 90 or whether we're 3. That brain learns by doing. So I'm going to teach it how to do something different.
When we know better, we do better.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, one of my early mentors, have you heard of Jim Rohn?
Oh, yeah.
Phenomenal author, speaker, business leader, thought leader, one of my early mentors in life and business. But he said, you know, my whole life I thought I didn't have the money. And his mentor said, it's not a lack of money, it's a lack of skills. And Jim Rohn says, up until now, I always thought being poor was a problem. And his mentor's like, no, you just don't have the skills on how to make more money. And that little tiny shift, that paradigm, made all of the difference. Just knowing that I either already have the skills or I possess a capacity to learn them is the empowerment that I think everybody, but especially today's youth, need to really grasp.
Desperately, they need it desperately, because we're handing, they're inheriting a world that's beyond their ability to repair.
I disagree. Well, but we're 90 minutes into the podcast, so we could go for another hour and a half
easily. Yeah.
I mean, I don't mind getting it up. If they're being handed a world that is beyond their ability to repair, then there really is nihilism and no reason to persist. So no, I still believe and need to fundamentally, just for my core sense of well-being, that what we do have are the opportunities to change course, and that we can make a difference.
I don't disagree with that at all. I think that when I said that, we can't save what we have, probably. I mean, that's what it looks like. So there's going to be some vast changes, and that's one of my true hopes for life. Is all about skills and skills and courses such like yours. Is that we can empower those kids to be able to work their way through the changes that are coming. Yeah. Because if they take the skills that they have right now, their emotional skills, they're toast.
Yeah, I don't want to continue on this trajectory and escalate. True. You're absolutely right. Like, we're not going to be able to hang on to and grasp and covet where we're at. We can't rewind the clock and get back to 1962 and then the moral ethical values that we had as a society back in a time better off. So all we can do is learn and adapt and create a better world that we want to live in.
Absolutely. And that's what I think, that's the rest of my life. You've got it in a nutshell.
I love and appreciate you, my friend. Your books are amazing, truly a gift. I recommend everybody reach out. Douglas's website is scrolling at the bottom. Do you have anything, any events coming up, any other ways that people can reach you? Are you on Facebook, Instagram? How do people get in contact with you?
If they go to douglasmckee.com, my email is there. They can feel free to do that. I post to, the Facebook, but I'm not active in anything else. I've been a hermit for quite a few years.
Well, I'm really glad that we've reconnected. I'm really excited with the work that you're doing for the veterans. I'm really grateful for the connections that you've given and offered me, meeting with Jay and all that has come from that. And I appreciate that you see the value of what we're trying to create. I look forward to sharing some of the brilliant concepts that you've come up with, like change the channel and competency and all that stuff, when I continue working with kids. Thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. When you have, if you've got a crew that needs to be, trained, send them my way and I'll do it.
Absolutely, my friend. I appreciate you, Douglas. Thank you so much.
Take care. Okay.
Bye. Thank you so much for listening to today's interview. I hope there's something in there that inspired you. I hope you're feeling empowered and awed, and something spoke to your soul and resonated with your heart. If you're interested in contacting today's guest, please check the show notes, follow him on Facebook, or send him an email. As always, please subscribe, rate, and review. And share this podcast with anybody that you know that might benefit from its message. This has been BC from A World Empowered, wishing you the very best. I love you all. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.